Welcome, welcome, Wahoo fans, to this week's edition of The Lockdown featuring T-Cub and the Ball Hawk. That's right, that's Petty Hawk always waiting, just lurking up in the piece. Special guest this week, former Cavalier great Demetrius Trey Nicholson is in the building and is blessing us, blessing the airwaves tonight. What's up, fam?
How you doing? It's good to be here, man.
Oh, man, good to have you,
bro. Hey, Trey, where you from, dog?
Oh, 7-5, Virginia Beach, Virginia, man. You already know.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Cub. You were saying, Cub?
You know what? Look, I can't say nothing. Trey, we already said we probably should call this the 757 lockdown because there's been so many, you know, former Cavalier greats from the 7-5 that, bro, it is what it is. Greatness is greatness. You know what I mean?
I can hear my 804 teammates right now, though, you know. I can hear their voices right now saying we need to get some 804 guys up there. So we used to have that debate in the locker room all the time. So
you know,
had a couple lately though. We had a couple lately.
Yeah. Hey. Well, we always down. So hey, you let them know we want them for real.
Absolutely.
So fam, like I said, it was good to see you, man, at the spring game a couple of weeks ago. Glad to see you back in the fold, man, and you know, being in Charlottesville now. And hey, coach. Coach Elliott want us there, bro. He want the alumni there. He want us to be present. So, you know, we going to show and prove. But I want to jump right into Coach Trey Nicholson. That's what – tell me about the coaching experience and how you got into that.
Oh, man. So it's funny because I wasn't necessarily looking to get into coaching, actually. I was trying to be a spectator for the sport for a little bit, you know, having spent so many years from childhood to all the way through college playing. And this opportunity came up. My wife and I were about to move to Lynchburg. And at the same time we were moving there, my cousin-in-law worked at Virginia Episcopal School. And I started job searching because my wife already found a job there. And as soon as I started job searching, he hit me up and told me that their school was looking for a coach and also someone that would teach and be an advisor and other things in the school. And I kind of fit the criteria, but I wasn't looking to coach necessarily. So I was pushing back against it. I'm like, no, I don't want to do it. Like, I can't do it. I'm not trying to coach. But ultimately, I ended up kind of following my heart for real. I'm like, this is probably what I need to do. Probably can't reach a bigger, you know, group of kids, impact people, and pass through the knowledge that I gained and, you know, the years of experience, things I was taught. So I ended up doing it and taking that position. And it was a great time. When I look back on it now, I'm happy I did. And I think I made the right decision. Mm-hmm. It was different being on the other side for sure. Mm-hmm. But it was great to be able to teach. And I found my niche again on the field. And, you know, I still had a passion for football, obviously. And I felt that I was able to relieve myself from some of that energy I had for still wanting to play in that passion by passing it on to my players and pushing them on the football field.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, and I think something that fans don't realize, man, is that when it's over and you don't get to do it anymore, I know for me, I was lightweight bitter a little bit, you know, because it's over, you know, and it's the not playing, the not being in the locker room with your guys. It's all of those things, man. And something that I tell the young boys that have aspirations to play at the next level, I say, look, it's all about you trying to fight for your next locker room right now. I said, because if you don't, then it ends right here. Your locker room, this is it. Enjoy it. That last game you played, that last one, that's it. You know,
absolutely. And
there's nothing huge, you can huge do to identity. Replace that.
Yeah, huge identity shift too at that point when you don't have that next game or you don't have that next practice. You start to try to figure out what it is that you need to be doing, you know, to fill that void a little bit.
Right. So how was
Hey Trey, go ahead, Cub.
How was it coaching 8-man football?
That was different. that was different. But what I did find was the way the game operated was the same as far as 100-yard field. The field was a little more narrow because it was only 8-man, but it was 100 yards. We punt, kick, return, kickoff, everything. So I had to kind of adjust what I know and concepts I know and things that I know in my mind to like this having eight men on the field, which had to, it took a little creativity because where you will want to run a certain defense, it's like, well, you got this hole right here. You can't really do that like you would do with 11 men. But I think it was good because it was a simple game. And the kids I was coaching, some of them never played football before. I had a wide range of kids on the team, some who never played and some who had a little bit of experience, some who played lacrosse, some who were wrestlers, swimmers. So in a lot of ways, I was happy because I was able to be their first football coach and actually teach them how to like actually play the game the right way and develop them in a way.
Right.
And it took some work. It took some molding. It took some of the kids, I had to kind of force them to get used to making contact with people. And then I had a couple of kids on my team who were just like, they just had it. They weren't afraid to compete. So it challenged me in a lot of ways, but I think the kids trusted me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, throughout the season, I had some other coaches with me who were helping out, who were big helps. And we adjusted our eight-man team that we had and our, mm-hmm. our schemes. And just made it work. It was a lot of fun, actually. And then by the end of the season, I think the best thing was just seeing, you know, the little scrawny guys who just came out for the first time actually try to run up and hit somebody, or, you know, see the wrestlers who I had playing line actually figure out how to fire off the ball. It was like the little things I saw, and I'm like, you know, they got it. And the team bonding was just out of this world. So it was a overall great experience, man. And I think I took a lot of really – I actually started off the season doing something Coach London did with us my very first year. This was back when like O'Day and Mo and all them was here and Rod and all them. He had us do this thing with this index card in one of our team meetings the night before the first game or throughout the season before the game, he'll read them. And we had to write like a time where we faced adversity in our life on the index card, but it was anonymous. Like no one knew who wrote what. And we all turned them in. And before every the night before every game that season, he would read one and you would just kind of learn about your teammates, but you won't know who he's talking about. And it just kind of made the team bond even tighter. And I took that idea from Coach London and I did that with my players. And I didn't know how it was going to turn out. Cause I'm like, some of these guys never, you know, played football. They don't really know what the football, you know, team culture and experience would be like. But that, I think that opened up their eyes to a lot. And when they were reflecting, they all talked about how much of, you know, brotherhood and family they felt like they had at the end of the season. And I'm just sitting here looking at these guys like, some of y'all never even played football before. And it was just it felt like a success seeing that.
Yeah, no doubt. Hawk, I know you had a question.
Yeah, so making that transition to eight-man football, what was something that you leaned towards looking at? Like, did you, like, I know arena football is different because they got guys in motion, but what were some of the things that you referenced to study to acclimate you to that transition, being that you played 11-man football? You talked about how the players made it easier because they were blank canvases, but you as a coach just mentally rewiring how you think.
Yeah, I actually, so my approach was when we were coaching them, I was coaching them like I was coaching 11-man football. I wouldn't, you know, when we got into concepts and plays and stuff, I would have to shift gears. But when we were doing drills, when we were like conditioning, when we were doing all the other stuff, and even when I was talking concepts, like I would try to teach them things like smash and like a drive concept and all this stuff. And I would use that terminology and I would tell them like, I'm going to coach y'all like we playing 11 man. But when we get to like learning our plays, obviously you're going to see the difference. So that was my initial approach. And then I think one of the things I had to learn was, you know, having, you know, five men on the line of scrimmage with that's three linemen and two tight ends, which, you know, it'd be essentially like seven men on the line of scrimmage for 11-man football. So it was like little nicks like that I had to like adjust and find. And our team, we were small. We had some small guys. We had a couple of guys who our linemen was our biggest lineman was probably like 155 pounds. But we had a couple of speedsters, guys who played lacrosse that can move, you know, quick on their feet, that can run routes. So what I found throughout the season was like an eight man, you can kind of isolate a one-on-one if you put like a trips to one side. So I just started kind of exploiting the one-on-ones. If we had a decent receiver who could catch and run a route and they had a DB that really couldn't cover. So I was just trying to find little tricks in the, you know, in the system where I can exploit it and get the ball out of our quarterback hands fast because we didn't have a power team. and we couldn't, you know, block for a long time. So if you go back and look at any of the film from VES in the years of 2019, you'll just see us throwing bombs and running like running jet sweeps and running slants. Like, it was simple. It was a simple game. It didn't work against everybody. We came up against Stab, actually, when they were playing eight man. They were some big boys. They was talented. And then we came up against Covenant. And matter of fact, Sanker's brothers was there. Yep. And they was going crazy out there. And I'm just sitting there. And my guys, like, you know, I'm just sitting there like, guys, we just gotta keep trying to show up. I mean, they faster, they bigger, they stronger. You just gotta do what you can do. It really was nothing I could help at that point, because we were just kind of outmanned as far as talent, you know. But yeah. So those were the two things we came up against, and I'm like, my hands are tied. I can't really, you know,
right.
There wasn't much I can really do at that point.
Then sometimes talent just supersedes.
Ran across that a couple of times. It was frustrating, man. I'm like, ah, like it's.
Yeah, them Sanker brothers were special at Covenant, man. They were special. Yeah.
Didn't one of them transfer to UVA?
Yeah, we got Jonas.
Yeah, we got one. Yep.
Jonas, yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, man. You know, Hawk and I are constantly harping on the 40-year decision that kids make when they come to University of Virginia, yes, because you won't play as long as you will outplay the amount of years in life that you will, you know, playing the sport. And yes, so, you know, to me, you are the consummate example of that. While you had a great career at Virginia, you also took your Bachelor of Science in Sociology and your Master's in Higher Education and Higher Education Administration, and tapped in to the afterlife, you know, to where it's led you now. Mm-hmm. And tell the fans a little about what you're doing now at St. Anne.
Yeah, so I got my Bachelor's in Sociology, and I got my Master's actually as an opportunity that came up when I was there for my fifth year after missing like the middle of my career there. And it was like a 1-year program that we were able to tap into. And you were going to be able to finish by the time you left, if you like did all the work you're supposed to do. So that came about. And then when I left, I knew I wanted to work where I would work with students, kids, help people. I didn't know exactly what that would look like necessarily. I didn't have a specific plan, but I knew that's what I wanted to do, be in a position where I can still just impact people and help pull people up. So when I left from UVA, I remember graduation, man. I'm sitting there thinking, like, I wasn't even excited for the master's graduation. I was thankful and happy, but I'm like, what am I about to do tomorrow? But I ended up moving to Baltimore for a year. And I worked at an inner city school there, and I loved it. And then from there, I moved back to Virginia Beach, and I worked as a student support specialist for 2 years. And a lot of my kids were kids who were coming from alternative schools, who were transitioning back from, being at in-home school. And, you know, some of them were coming from foster care. So I was working with those students and helping them integrate back. So I knew that's kind of what I wanted to do. And I'm like, I wanted to be a counselor. I wanted to have that, like, that licensure. So, and then from there, I moved to Lynchburg, and that's when I was there for the last two years and coaching. I ended up teaching U.S. history. So I had a U.S. history class I was teaching. I was working as an advisor. I was gaining all this experience. And then I got into a grad program, and I got accepted into the University of Lynchburg's grad counseling program. And I've been working through that the last year, actually. And then ended up at St. Anne's this past year when I moved back to Charlottesville, met some of the administrators over there, and they were looking at my resume and just trying to see where I could fit in at the school and where the need is. And I just interviewed, and right now I work at the upper school and the Learning Village, which are the two separate campuses. So I'm kind of stretching between grades 5 through 12. But next year I'm gonna be the school counselor for grades 4 through 8. So it's been like a journey of navigating through the education system, just seeing what fits, taking advantage of opportunities, not being afraid to like reach out, put myself out there a little bit, do stuff I never done before. I never thought I would be teaching U.S. history when I was teaching it, but I ended up doing it. I didn't even think I could do it well, but I ended up having a great time doing that and ended up loving teaching. So it was a matter of me just exploring, really, and stepping out and staying true to like what I believe is at my core, which is like wanting to help students, help kids, making sure everybody has an equal chance to be successful.
Right. Where did that come from? I mean, do you think it was from, you growing up young, your mom was very young when she had you, and dad wasn't in your life necessarily. Talk a little bit about where that came from in your background.
Yeah, I realized the older I get, I realized that, despite all the other stuff, that growing up as a kid, that I was kind of going through, I was always nurtured by my mom and my great grandma. Like always felt loved despite everything else that was going on. And I think that really helped build my character a little bit. Mm-hmm. Just always being nurtured and also being held accountable. So I think when you blend the two, you kind of get me. And I realized too growing up that everybody don't always have that person, so some of my friends who were kind of similar situations, or kids now who are in a similar situation, they might not have that person in their life that make them feel loved or cared for or supported. So they might go down the wrong path, or they might not have that person that encourage them. So they might go down the wrong path. But I know the difference it can make when you do, despite what you're going through, when you do have like a support system, how different that can be and how it can really change the direction of where you go in life. And it only takes really one or two people. It don't even take a whole lot. It don't take I know the saying goes, it takes a village to raise a child. And it's part of that saying, but it really only takes one or two people to believe in you and to say like, man, you can do this. Or matter of fact, don't do that. Come this way. Let me show you how to do this. Or, have you ever thought about doing this? And taking time really to see past people's struggles and challenges, I think that's a big deal in life. And I think that's something that I know helped me out growing up. I always had people in my corner, and I think it can help other people.
Yeah. Well, when you have those lived experiences though, man, you can translate it back to say, hey, you know what? I've been through some shit like this. What I'm saying? And so understand, I'm not just up here paying lip service to it. When I'm talking to you and the things that I'm keeping it a 400 with you, it's because I have lived this. You know what I'm saying? And so you have a credibility that someone else would not have. The hard part is when you're talking to kids, you got to get their trust, because they don't trust people because, their home situation may be fucked up. May be a dad that's in prison or a mom that's on drugs and grandma had to raise, it may be a situation like that. And so someone like yourself who has been through some shit, who has been through some adversity, can speak to a kid like that and change the course of their life, potentially change the course of their lives. What I'm saying?
Yeah. And I can still kind of feel some of that too. When I see somebody going through something, I can feel it. Cause I know what it's like, to your point. I know what it's like. It's like, I can feel that, even though I'm not going through that right now, I can relate. And it creates that trust when you are able to like connect on that level with people like, listen, I've been there, So.
Yeah. And that's why it's important for us, man, to make sure that we are constantly mentoring, and nurturing these young guys that are coming, because they only know what they know. I'm saying? And so, we may have thought we did. I may have thought I did things the right way, and I did. But then, as you get older, be like, damn, I wish I would have known this. I wish somebody would have put me up on game on this, And so if we don't then turn around and say, all right, I got to make sure that these dudes coming on this next ride, that they know exactly the steps to take. If we don't do that, then we dead ass wrong. You know what I'm saying? Absolutely. Because as we say, kids, they know what they know. Well, we know what they should know because we have the lived experiences that we talked about. And so now we can impart that wisdom on them. So when I tell a kid, look, I need you to go down the street, cross over before you make the left. Don't ask me questions, just cross over before you make the left. And then when you get over there and you do what I say, you'd be like, damn, if I would have made that lift, I would have fell in that damn hole. Well, shit, I fell in that damn hole. So that's why I'm telling you to cross over, you know, but you gain the credibility once you have lived it. And the kids are like, damn, you know what? These OGs have been on these grounds. You know, mm-hmm. they have been on this field. They have put in that work. And so kudos to you, man, for taking your upbringing and wanting to uplift the young dudes that's coming through. Yeah. Because that shit is so important, fam. So important. Yeah,
sure. Absolutely.
Well, shoot, bro, we gonna jump all the way back to Bayside High School then, you know, I mean, since we, you know, we ain't went back yet. So, you know, let's take it back there. Defensive back, wide receiver extraordinaire, Bayside High School, Gatorade Player of the Year 2010, the only player in Virginia that was at the Under Armour game, first team, all Under Armour, all American. Damn, but you just did the damn thing coming out though, fam. For real, for real?
Yeah, man. I you know, my biggest goal was really just to get a scholarship. That was my one goal, man. Like, that was my focus, my mission, all the other stuff. You know, I'm happy to be, you know, I'm proud to be recognized, but my goal was to make sure I had a school to go to. I just needed one, you know. Right. So, you know, I'm happy all that, you know, I was thankful and blessed and humbled to get recognized for a lot of that stuff, but that was my one goal, and I, you know, was able to accomplish that. So I knew my peoples weren't gonna be able to pay for me to go to college. That really wasn't, it wasn't a huge option for me. So,
right.
Yeah, it was a good time though. Good times.
What other schools were higher on your list coming out?
And UNC. And UNC was like my number one school for a long time. That's the school they were the first school to offer me. Mm-hmm. And that was the school I was going to go to for a long time until, they had ran into a situation where their school was being investigated. And this is right before when I was about to come out of high school. And then they all, like, Butch Davis ended up getting fired. And so all of his assistant coaches. So I ended up kind of scratching them off the list because they was on probation. They weren't going to be able to go to no bowl games, no matter what, you know, if they won six games or not. And that kind of really threw me. So I'm like, oh no, what's going to happen with their program? But I was big on UNC. I went and visited Stanford, but when I was out there, and this was cool because this was when like Richard Sherman and Andrew Luck was still there and I got to see them in college. But when I got out there, I asked, and Harbaugh was there actually. When I got there, I asked, I said, so do y'all pay for like our family to come to the games? And the guy told me like, they get tickets, but we don't pay for their, you know, their airfare. So at that point, I'm like, nah. In my mind, I'm like, I can't be way out here. Like, you know, I know my mom and my family gonna want to come to the games. So that kind of scratched Stanford off the list. And really, like, UVA were late offering me. I really didn't know much about UVA football, even growing up. You know, I knew Virginia Tech because Michael Vick, you know. So once I started kind of getting into UVA and I met Coach London, then they kind of like shot to the top of the list. And I came to visit, and my official visit, we had beat Miami. This one, they like knocked out two of their quarterbacks, and like Rod and Chase and all them was catching interceptions, and I'm just sitting in the crowd like I'm kind of excited to see Miami, but UVA like working them, and I'm like, because I've never been to a big college game at this point. That was my first, you know, my first one on my official visit. And it was just a great atmosphere, and then also like Henry Coley was here, and he was hosting me, and he was my old teammate at Bayside. So it was a good visit. It was a great time, and I connected with all the coaches. So they shot up to my list pretty high, and then it was just kind of consistent from there. My mom was with me. She had a good time. It was only about 2.5 hours from back home, so I knew they could drive up there to see their home games and games at Carolina, stuff like that. So it was, you know, it was almost at that point, like, yeah, I'm probably gonna go here.
So Trey, who was your lead recruiter? Who was the person that contacted you the most?
Coach West was recruiting me.
Okay.
But Coach Reed used to hit me up all the time. Like, Coach Reed used to he used to write handwritten letter notes like every week and send them. And then one day I came in to visit, and it was like I just came up one weekend, and I'm talking to him, and I always like look right at him and eye contact when I'm talking to him. He's sitting in the chair and I'm talking. He was like, "Have you ever pictured yourself?" You know, he got like the Boston accent. He like, "Have you ever pictured yourself in the in a UVA uniform?" I'm like, "I have." He's like, "You know what you would look like?" I'm like, "You know, like straight like, oh no." And he like pointed up to his like little shelf thing. He had like a Photoshop of like my head on a UVA body, like a player's body. It was, that was just a funny memory. Yeah. But he was Coach West and Coach Reed were the two that was on me the most. And Dex came down one time to Bayside with them and they all visited. So yeah, they was cool.
Did you know about, so I you know, you said a name that I know fans gonna, they caught what you said now. You knew about Virginia Tech because of Michael Vick. Did you know anything about Coach Poindexter? And if you didn't, when you found out about who he was, did it shock you who he was?
Yeah, I did not know about UVA football. I'm gonna be honest. Like growing up, I did not know about UVA football. And I don't know. I don't know. It just wasn't something I always heard, you know. And I wasn't really the one that was all into watching all this college football either when I was growing up initially. And the big game that was on TV, you know, that I used to see was, you know, it would be like the, all these bigger, like bigger quote unquote football schools at the time. So yeah, once I started figuring out who Dex was and like doing and like starting to see like the history of UVA, I'm like, oh yeah. And then like seeing like guys from back home, like, you know, all this history, you know, all you guys. And it was like, this is like my home school basically to me, you know? And that was big for me too. I was like, a big part of my commitment was I want to play for, why would I go to another state and play? And I don't know other players who do that. Like do what's best for you. You know, I tell everybody, all players, like go where you feel loved, man, where you want to go and play. But I personally felt like, I want to play for my home school. Like it felt more important to me to be from Virginia, to play for Virginia. Like it just, that also felt like a no brainer, but that could just be my values. So that was another part of it. All that played into it.
Smoke said something similar though. So I feel you. He was just like, yo, it was like, you know, protect the state. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We going there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah,
it would be weird to me playing for another school and like, you're about to go play Virginia. And I'm like, I want to go play my you know, my home, basically. Right. I could go and help my home team.
Right. So before
and UVA wasn't coming out, they weren't high on like they weren't like ranked or nothing crazy.
No.
They were just UVA still at the time. I mean, they had some big wins though, and that Miami win put the seal on. I'm like, we can actually win here, you know, like it's they compete hard. It's not like I just never seen it. So once I seen it, it was like, oh yeah, like it's we can do this.
Good stuff. So before we jump into your first year, we have to ask you one quick question.
Yeah.
Did you play any other sport besides football?
I ran track.
Okay. What'd you run?
I ran indoor, I ran outdoor, and then I played football. And that was my like cycle.
Okay. What were your events? Yeah.
I ran in indoor, I ran the 55 and the 4x2. And outdoor, I ran the 1, the 2, the 4x1, and occasionally the 4x4. My coach would be like, we need a leg. So that 400, that 400 is a tough race.
That's a grown man race right there.
It's a man race, but that was my training regimen, really. I won't just like playing football and then like not doing anything in the off season.
Gotcha. So then, you know, you come to UVA. Did you feel like you were ready to roll first? Because I mean, you were one of the first freshmen to start a season opener since one of my teammates, Kevin Cook. So did you feel like you were ready from the gate, or did you feel like, whoa, I could probably use a season of the slow roast for a redshirt year?
Personally, I felt like I could cover everybody, like playing man. Like I felt like I can guard anybody and cover, you know. Once we got out there, I remember I felt like I was ready. I felt like I was small, but I never doubted that I was ready. I remember our first one-on-ones, my very first one was against like Matt Snyder. And he was like, Matt was probably like 6'5" receiver. And he like ran, he just tried to run a go route, and I just ran with him, opened up and like broke the pass up. And I'm like, all right. You know, that was my very like getting my feet wet. You know, I'm like, all right, like that was all right, you know. And then like it was other times where it'll get a little crazier, like, you know, going up against like Tim Smith, who, you know, was different from like Matt Snyder. They all had different, you know, Matt was just bigger body. Tim was like faster, you know, can get out of his breaks fast. But I felt ready. But what I tell guys now that I'm older, is like, don't feel rushed to play. So it's funny though, now that I'm older, looking back, because I felt like I wanted to go somewhere and play. I felt like I could play, you know, like I'm trying to play somewhere right now. And now that I'm older, I'm looking back like, it's nothing wrong with not playing your first year. You know, you can go there and still, you can go somewhere and still develop. And then when you actually step out there, then you're even better than you were when you were going to first step out there coming out of high school. So that's like my advice I kind of pass down now. You know, I just tell guys, like, if you do have an opportunity to play and you want to, yeah, but don't feel pressured by nobody to, you know, feel like you have to play your first year, because you don't. And you can still have a successful successful college career, you know, better than you probably would if you just came right out of high school. And for me, I was kind of smaller. I was a smaller guy too. So, you know, I think if I would have waited a year, I probably would have had an even better, like, you know, coming out year than when I first came out of high school.
Gotcha. But shoot, but you balled your first year. I mean, you had 2 picks. You were fourth on the team with 60 tackles. You know, you tied with the team lead with Chase Minnie, and on the other side with 8 pass breakups. How did you feel playing across from Minnie? And were you able to learn some things from Minnie?
Man. So like that summer when we got to school, like Chase, Rod, Dom Joe, Corey Mosley, like, you know, Rio, like all those guys were like, they've been there. So when I came, they just kind of really took me under their wing, like all of them. But Chase in particular, Chase was different. Like he would, all summer, this man would work out like 3 times a day. And like when we first got there, we weren't able to work out with the older guys yet, but he would hit me up like, I'm going to do drills. So we'll work out in the morning, I'll have class. And then like, I'll get out of class. He was like, yo, I'm about to go do drills. Like, you trying to come? He'll come over to Gooch Dillard where we live. Yeah, this one, he had like the little black Mercedes. He'll pick me up, we'll go do drills, right? And then like, this will be like midday kind of, or like afternoonish. So then we'll do drills. He'll have his tripod out there. Like he'll be recording. It'll just be us. And like, he'll be recording. And I know he was probably doing more so for himself, but he had me with him. But he'll be recording his drills. He'll go back and like study himself. You know, he'll help coach me up on like things he's doing. And then like, that'll be that session. And then in the same day, like later that evening, he'll be like, yo, we're going to run the stadiums. It would be like Chase. They had like this pack. It was like Chase, me, Rio. It was like all the DBs. Just go and do another workout, like go run either stadiums, or he had like different checkpoints throughout the city that he would run around at each checkpoint. We had jump ropes tied to our waist because we'll get to different checkpoints and like jump rope. But he was different, man. Like I loved his, I learned a lot from his preparation and just how he approached every game. He was so locked in. Rod was always locked in. Rod was like a robot out there. And Simo is just like the wild one. Like I heard Simo say some of the craziest stuff on the field. I was like, you know, I knew he was for real, and he would come up and hit you, you know. But just, you know, and Dom Joe was like, had all this wisdom and like always took me on his wing and like will share, you know, things that will help me make me better, and Rio the same way. So like, and I hope I'm not forgetting anyone, but those are just the guys that pop off my head right now. It was different, man. They took me under their wing, and I kind of just adapted to them and learned a lot from them. And just having Chase around that first year, just seeing how he prepared for practices, like for camp. He was preparing for camp. He was watching film like we was about to go play, you know, Virginia Tech. You know, he was like studying it. all the way to a point one time when we were at practice and he knew Big Mo was about to pull. He just ran up and hit Big Mo and like, and Mo fell, but he knew he was running to him before he even pulled, you know? So like his whole like idea of like how he approached the game really rubbed off on me. And I saw like what it really take to be successful at that level from all of those guys. And I was just happy. I was humbled to be able to be around all of them and play with them in that secondary.
Yeah, and I think that speaks volume to just a veteran player because just referencing from like an article I just read about like Ryan Tannehill, how he said he doesn't have to mentor the quarterback from Liberty. And I just never understood why you had some vets who didn't take a young guy under their wing. So you got to look at it like this, like Chase is a corner and you are a young corner coming in, but he takes the time to show you the ropes, show you how to truly prepare. Because one thing that always jumped out of me about Chase, and Chase will laugh about this, Chase knew how to cheat. And the only way you can get a cheater as a DB is you got to understand the tricks of the trade, understand what refs are looking for. But you have to study to learn how to cheat and not get caught. And he was always very studious. I remember the stories about how his dad would watch those that videos of him taping himself. He would share stuff with his dad. And that's a dude that, because if I'm not, and I don't think I'm wrong about this, your first collegiate game, you had a pick. Did you have a pick six that game?
Yeah, William and Mary, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So take us into that play. Like, what did you see? Was it something that you picked up from him that helped you get a pick six, your very first collegiate game?
I think it was understanding, like, and Coach West would preach this too, but Chase would, like, also, like, reinforce it, and then Coach Reed would also, like, reinforce it, but it was, like, down and distance, alignment, understanding what the defense is. We were running bullets. I remember this, like, no tomorrow. It was, like, third and 12. It was like, third and 12. We were running bullets, so I knew the ball was coming out fast. And all game, like, it was a couple times the receiver ran a curl, but they didn't throw it. And this time, I'm like, all right, I know the ball will come out. You got, like, Roy and Steve Greer blitzing. So, you know, I'm like, all right, the ball got to come out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, they going. I'm like, it's third and 12. I'm going to play the sticks, you know. And this is all terminology that I mean, in high school, I wasn't really that focused on it. I mean, I understood, like, the game and, like, stuff like that, but it was more narrow focus this time. So that was, in that particular play, you know, I just understood the situation. And I think that was the first instance where I realized, like, wow, like, if you know what's coming, like, and you got this idea, like, you can really, like, make these plays. But yeah, we blitzed, they ran, like, the dude ran like a sticks route, and I was able to just hop it. And, you know, that was the first time I'm like, yeah, this is how you do it. This is how you take your preparation and apply it to the field and trust what you see when you see it, you know, because you saw it on film a million times and you practiced it, and, you know, just trust it when you see it.
And, you know, it's refreshing to hear that information that you share, man, because T-Cover myself, we get redundant a lot of the times when we break down, like, the last season when we talk about the DB position, how, yeah, you want that the physical attributes, but the mental is where you win the majority. Like, you earn your victories before you even step on the field because, as you said, you not only knew assignment, where the ball is spent down the distance, but you also knew the defense, who's blitzing, where the ball will have to come out to beat us. You know what I'm saying? It's so much that goes into football and playing defensive back, especially corner, that it gets lost to how brilliant you guys can be, to where before the play even starts, you knew they had been running this curl, but we running this time. They got to come right there. And that's a young player.
Absolutely. Yep, that's true, man. It's complex, and you gotta think about all that. And I don't think people know, like, you know, I don't think fans really know, like, what goes into it, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, and that's why we love bringing guests up here that play positions, because, like I said, man, it's like you talking to your child. Like, you can tell your child right from wrong 24/7, but when somebody outside the house tells them the same thing, it registers more. Mm-hmm. So you know, it's a great, you know, we just had Juan on here. Tim Harris before that, now yourself, you know, former defensive back that can speak to what's between the ears a lot of the times that really allows you to make plays on the ball.
Absolutely, man. It takes a lot. It's a lot that goes into it, man. And every play too. Like and the one play you have like a mental lapse is the big play you give up a lot of the time. You know, it can be a mental lapse in the technique. It can be like a false step. It can be, you know, you're looking in the backfield, you're looking at the wrong thing. So it's definitely it's a complex position.
Yeah.
No doubt. Sure. Dude. And then, you know, then you roll into your second year, man, and you have a lights out year, man. You were tied for the ACC lead in pass breakups with 15, number four and again on the team in tackles with 56. Another banner year. And then you roll into your third year and the damn injury bug just hits you like crazy, man. You know, and talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, man, that was my first time like being injured, where I was like injured and like out.
You weren't hurt.
I was like out, and I was like out for some time. But like even my third year, man, I felt, you know, and granted we had like a new coaching staff in a lot of ways, and it was a different vibe a little bit. But I felt like I was having a good year that year too. Like it's starting off with like pass breakups, and I had a pick against Pitt, actually Tyler Boyd, you know, like just I felt like it was going decent that year. But then when that injury happened, man, when it happened, I actually thought I rolled my ankle because I just felt this sharp pain in my foot. And we were playing Ball State, and I got up and I'm like, I know I couldn't have broke my ankle because my ankle's taped. That's my thought process. So I'm like, I'm gonna just walk it off. So after that play happened, they actually scored. The play I got injured on, they scored because we all like kind of mashed in, tried to make a tackle, and my foot got rolled up on. But the guy broke. So then they score, and our offense go out there. We throw a pick like first play. So they like sudden change. So I'm like, all right, we gotta go right back out there. So we run out there, and at the time, I still feel it a little bit, but I'm like, I'm gonna just, you know, see what's going on. So the first play, actually, they ran a zone read to the left, but my guy ran like an out route, but they didn't throw it. But when I tried to plant, like I just felt this sharp pain in my foot, and I told our safety Brandon Phelps, I'm like, yo, Brandon, I'm like, yo, my foot messed up. He like, bro, just go down. I'm like, no, I'm gonna wait. I'm gonna wait. That's literally what I told him. I said, I'm gonna wait. And then they ran another running play, luckily. And I tried to break again. My dude still ran like a route, but it was a running play. And I tried to break, and I realized like, all right, I'm a liability to my team at this point. Like I can't be out here. So then I went down, and then like, you know, the trainers came out, and they initially like tried to tape my toe down so it can't like flex up, but it was just so painful. Like no tape or anything was going to like help at that point. So then like I ended up missing like. That took a lot of time to heal, and I ended up missing the rest of that season. Tried to come back in the spring, and it was just still like mad painful to break and run and stuff. So then they were starting to talk about me having surgery on it. And at this point, it's late in the game. It's like May. So, you know, I tried to go through spring and everything, and I was, you know, I'm like, it's still like the sharp pain in my foot. I don't know what's going on. It didn't heal properly or whatever. So when they started talking surgery, I'm like, so what's the time frame for me coming back for my fourth year? And they were like, you know, it might be close, but you were going to be pushing leak going into like your fourth year, like, I'm sorry, missing time. So I was stuck kind of with this dilemma, like, you know, I really didn't know what to do. Like, do I try to fix my foot so it's fully healed? And then try to come back later in my fourth year, you know, at this point I missed all that time. So I ended up like having the surgery, and then my recovery like ended up taking longer than I thought. So that leaped into year four. And then this was before like the whole like red shirt thing was, the rules were different back then.
Yeah.
I say back then, like it feels a long time ago, but the rules are different back then. So I ended up, once I was able to start running and planting, I ended up trying to come back and trying to like force myself to play a little bit. And so I'm like, I gotta get back on the field. Cause at this point it's like, I didn't miss like more time in football than I ever missed in my life, you know? When I came back and they like, they said, you can try to play in this game, but anything after this game, you know, if you play, then essentially like, you know, regardless of how your foot feels, you're not gonna be at a red shirt. You're not gonna be able to have a medical red shirt. So if you play it and you get injured or you injure your foot more, then that's just my fourth year. It is what it is. So I'm like, all right. So I tried to play in Kent State game. And I think it was like, I don't know. I was feeling all right. I think it was more adrenaline than anything. But after that game, like the next day I woke up, my foot was like bruised again. Like couldn't really extend my toe. It was a weird and like crazy situation I was in. So I ended up applying for a medical red shirt, and that's what allowed me to come back up for a fifth year to be there for that season. But I ended up like not being able to play the rest of that season, rehabbing, just trying to get back to my full self. And as many athletes might know, like after you have surgery, that's hard to do to get back to your regular self. When I did come back, I didn't feel great. I was happy to be able to come back. I felt healthy. I did feel like I lost a step a little bit on top of like just not being out on the field for so long, but I was grateful to have an opportunity to come back and, you know, be able to try to help my team wherever I could at that point. So it was, that injury bug was a huge turning point for me. But you know, I'm a firm believer of like, you know, it happened to me. It happened for a reason. Who knows? Yep. You know? So I just kind of had to roll with the punches at that point and you know, get through it.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like, how did you feel? Because I mean, I know, I'm sure you had aspirations of playing at the next level. And then, you know, being able to come back to try to play that your last year, feeling like you lost a step. How did that impact you kind of mentally, man? You know, when that you realized that the next level wasn't going to happen for you.
Yeah, it was tough, man. Like I took the route of like still want to pursue it, but coming to the realization that it's probably not, my chances are even more slim at this point. And also didn't physically feel like I felt earlier in my career at that point. And also mentally, because when you like don't physically feel great, it's like mentally you don't feel like you can do the same things.
Yeah.
But I think like the opportunity was still kind of there. It was still brewing a little bit, but I think it was very, very narrow. It's already narrow anyways, but I think it was even more narrow. And I think I took like a realistic look at it, at the situation, and said like, you know, I need to really figure out like what I'm going to do, because I think like if, and who knows, I don't think if I would have was to go to the next level, I don't think I would have played a long time at the next level. So I was really like looking at myself introspectively and like, and thinking about my life and like, what do I need to do? So I was still kind of training for a little bit, even after I graduated, and still working out, just still kind of like staying ready-ish for any opportunity that come up. I contemplated like going to trial for a CFL team and like thinking of all these different routes to still play football. And I came to the realization like, all right, at this point I'm 24, well, I was about to turn 24, and it's never too late for nobody. You know, people are all on their own journey, but for me, I'm like, I'm 24, I can keep trying to chase this thing, you know, for as long as I, you know, chase it, and who knows what comes out of it, or I can start trying to like really figure out what I need to do in my life in terms of other opportunities. So I took that route, and that was hard for me to do, because that's all I know was playing football and, you know, all my life. But I took that route. I kind of was real with myself. Looked myself in the mirror, like, you know, this is probably what you need to do. And not saying that, you know, to pursue the other opportunity would have been bad, because it, you know, I think people should reach for their dreams, go long and far if they have to. But I think for me, it was more of a, I think this is more realistic at this point in my life and, you know, how I'm feeling. And it was hard mentally, but it's still hard mentally, like today, you know, tomorrow is going to be, and thinking back is going to be, even some days, like watching football, it's like, dang, what if? But I don't want to be that guy. I'm just more realistic. Like, this will happen. This is where I am. This is what I'm trying to do now. Just trying to stretch myself to pursue other things and try to use my other, you know, use the skills that I've, not the athletic skill, but the character skills, the things you need to be a great player, great teammate, and apply it to, you know, other areas. So.
Yeah. Well, you can have an impact, bro. Like I said, you know, what we talked about at the top is you have the credibility because you've been there, done that, you know, yes, and you have a skill that you can, when you watch a guy's work, you can say, you know, you can walk up to a joker and say, hey, this is what I'm seeing. Hey, as far as your technique, have you tried this? Blah, 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 blah. You can, you know, you can put them up on game for real. Absolutely. And yeah, they're gonna trust what you say. You know what I'm saying? Because you've been there, you've been through the wars. And so please continue to know that you play a role in any young man's life for real.
Yeah, because a lot of times, man, the hardest transition for guys who were with inside that bubble, and I always say, like, student athlete, we're in the bubble, like, because all we know is our sport and our class.
Yeah,
that's our routine. A lot of times we feel like we're worthless and useless now when we don't play our sport. And the great thing about going to this university called the University of Virginia is that degree holds a lot of weight, and you learn a lot of tools that you didn't know because we were so focused on our sport, our job, in a sense. And that's all we thought we were, was football players. And UVA prepares us for that next phase of life. And it takes certain individuals, they can understand their worth after they're done. Another individual, it takes alum like a Tony Covington to bring that out of you. Like, hey, man, you know, you're more than just a football player. Football does not hold dominion over you anymore. And once you free yourself of that dominion, the world is a beautiful thing, man. You understand, like, damn, I was missing out, bro. You know what I'm saying? Like, if I could go back, because I'm like you, if I could go back, I wish I would have redshirted my first year, in a sense, so I could get that master's degree. But not only that, I wish it would have been folks really around me to help me see the world while I was within that bubble, because it would have made that transition that much easier. So
absolutely, man. I always tell, like, I always think about, like I remember one of my professors at UVA, Claudina Harrell, actually, you guys might know her name, but the realest thing I heard in college was from her, and it wasn't even a fact about history or nothing. It was like, she said, don't leave college the same way you came. And like, that really stuck with me. And now I think back, you know, I tell, like, my brother-in-law, he's a young student athlete right now in college, and other student athletes that I know in high school who are pursuing college, I'm like, listen, when you go there, like, tap into everything, like, whatever you have the opportunity to. Don't limit yourself to this one single identity where you walk around with your athletic backpack and your sweatsuit every day. I'm like, don't get to know all these other people around you, and, like, you know, you gotta tap into that stuff. And that's one thing I would have did even more. I think my red shirt, me having that red shirt allowed me to do that. But a lot of kids don't, you know, get that opportunity to redshirt, and they don't understand, like, the resources they have around them. So I, you know, that's my biggest thing, man, for kids now. I'm like, tap into whatever school you're at. Like, it's so much more you can take with you when you leave versus, like, film study and games and, like, experience from athletics. It's so much more you can leave in 4 years with, and your degree, obviously. But I think that's something that needs to continue. And they pushing that UVA now, you know, even more than they were back then. And Coach Lundy used to push that a lot too. But I just think across the college landscape, for some athletes who don't go pro, they need to just understand that, like, it's, you can take a lot from that school you're at. You just gotta step out, you know.
That's real, man. And that's where the alumni come in, you know, because nobody told us those things, you know. Yeah. So me having to, you know, live life understanding, okay, I had the degree, they told me to get it, the jobs would come when it was over, damn, they lied. The job's not coming, you know, because, you know, there was no internships. There wasn't networking. Nobody told, like I said, I did the things they told me to do. They didn't tell me to do those things. And so the onus is on us once again to now make sure that we put these young boys up on game when it comes to that. Absolutely. Help them secure these internships, you know, teach them how to network because they don't know. I mean, there's been times where I have tried to have a young man network with somebody and I'd have made the connection. I'm like, okay, cool. I talked to him a year later. Hey, when last time you talked to such and such? When you introduced us. What?
Yeah. And,
you know, but because like I said, then it occurred to me, it was like, damn, he didn't know that he needed to, just to be consistent with it. And it's not, you know, it's just simple as an email or a text or something just to keep him in the loop, let him know what's going on. You express your interest in this particular field.
It goes such a far ways too. Like to the intern piece, I got to intern that fifth year because we were like finished school, but for our grad program, we had to intern. So I had a chance to intern at the Career Center. At the Career Center. So, and when I was there, like I saw, and these were like regular students, I saw first years, second years coming into the Career Center with resumes, looking for like, they looking for internships on Capitol Hill and like all this stuff. And I'm sitting there like, I just made my resume. I'm a grad student. I like just made my resume and I just like got the people who I'm like interning for to help me get my resume up and running. And, and these kids are still in college, they're in the middle of college, like looking for summer interns and like externships. And like, I'm just thinking to myself, like, wow, man, like if I would have been in here my first year, really, if I had the mindset I have now, like I would have started like just looking for stuff. You know, I would have known I could play football. Like I can play football. I'm going to go to my meetings and practice workouts, but like, this is a Career Center here. Like I can go right over here and start building a whole nother type of thing for myself. In the case that this doesn't work out, you know, but that was the most ironic thing of how I ended my fifth year in college, like interning at the Career Center, which I was thankful for. And I learned a lot. So, you know, like you said, it's just talking to the young guys and making sure they know too, what's available for them.
Yeah. Before we let you get out of here, man, I got two more things. One is Jim Reed versus John Tenuta. Tell me about those two. Tell me about those experiences.
Like what about him just in general?
This is Petty Tony, fellas. This is Petty Tony, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm a fan of one and I'm not of the other. So I just want to hear what your experience was like, your interaction with those two individuals.
Yeah, I would start off by saying, like, obviously Coach Reed was the one who recruited me. He was the one who was who I built a stronger relationship with coming out of high school. And who I like kept a relationship with while I was in college. He always had like a open door type policy. You can come talk to him about anything, really. You know, he pushed us. I think his defense was he allowed us to just try to play fast. It was simple and fast. And I was upset when he got fired, honestly. And I remember I tweeted something. I tweeted like change is inevitable, but we gotta like roll. I tweeted something like that, like right after it happened, and I saw like all these media people started retweeting me. So I like went and deleted the tweet. I'm like, well, that's not even what I was aiming for. And, you know, I'm not even a big like social media type guy, right? But I'm like, yeah, let me just delete that because I'm not trying to stir nothing up, but and have people interviewing me. But I had a deeper connection with Coach Reed, I will say that, and deep love for Coach Reed. You know, he always asked how my mom doing. Like he made me feel like connected to him. When Coach Tenuta came in, I was a couple things. One, when he came in the first spring, he came in, I had pulled my hamstring over working out back home prior to spring ball. So I didn't even get to, that was a whole nother thing that I forgot about. I didn't even get to play in the first spring that he was here. So I never really got to build type of relationship with him, and he didn't, he just didn't really know me as on that level as Coach Reed, because Coach Reed recruited me. So I think I missed more time with Coach Tenuta. I think that kind of played into, you know, obviously me being at a fully show what I can do. I think Coach Reed was more of a player's coach. I don't think Coach Tenuta is much of a player's coach necessarily. Mm-hmm. I think his defensive schemes were a lot more in some ways like complex as far as what we did. But I don't know, man. It was definitely a different vibe. It was a different vibe when Coach Tenuta came in versus when Coach Reed was there. It was a different vibe.
I was curious. I was curious, from your perspective, because we've gotten a couple of different perspectives of Tenuta and Coach Reed. Yeah. Last thing, we have something, we end our podcast each week with something called Shut the Hell Up, I'm Underdog. And what that is something that gets under your skin. I mean, really bothers you, but you're like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to overcome it anyway. Holla. Yeah. It could be sports related or not.
Oh, man, that's tough. I'm going to kind of go a little deep, I think, just because, like, I kind of see this. But, like, I think, like, people judging and stereotyping people is a big one for me, because, and it wasn't at one point, but I think now that I like work with other people in general, and over the course of like the last couple of years of seeing how like systems and policies work, I kind of see how I can't even explain it, man. That's a deep question. But what gets under my skin is like the way some people are viewed, and they're treated because they're viewed that way before they're even given the same opportunity as some other people. And I'll just say that. And I think the older I'm getting, the more I'm realizing it, and the more I'm reading stuff and, you know, reading books and educating myself more, it's just becoming more obvious and apparent. And it gets under my skin like every other day. Some days I wake up like, try not to be mad today at this, like, because you know it's going to be right in your face today. But, you know, I realize, like, you know, whatever, like, it is what it is. You know, just got to keep working to overcome, you know, the system in a lot of ways. And that, I know that's a broad term, the system, but I mean that in like a lot of ways, really.
Yeah, controlling what you can control, man. Your effort, your attitude, and your
output. Y'all gotta tell people about that question before you ask that one, man. That's a hard one right there.
Well, normally I give you the heads up early, you know. that old man brain, I just forgot. I normally it happens. My bad, dog.
It's all good.
And you the first one, man, and you handled it well.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
You handled it very well. Well, fam, we sure appreciate you coming on, man. It's been great. Glad you're in Charlottesville, because, you know, Hawk is there and I'm there on a regular basis, man, to make sure we can get together, man, chop it up, break bread, and make sure we pouring into these young boys that Coach Elliott is charged with overseeing and wanting to make a difference and an impact. So we need you, brother, and just thank you, bro. Love you, man.
Thank you, man. It's always a pleasure to hear and talk to you guys and still learn from you guys, man, and hear y'all voice. So
no doubt. Well, Wahoo fans, this has been another episode of The Lockdown featuring T-Cove and the Ball, and special guest Demetrius Trey Nicholson. Until next week, we are out.
757 Trey, baby.
There he go.